Judiciary Committee for Wednesday, May 2, 2007. We're going to go roughly in the order of the agenda here, but because Senate Bill 260 had stimulated a certain amount of discussion when it was last before us, I'm going to wait until we have a little more of our committee in the room before we take it up. So we're going to go first to Senate Bill 322. I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 322.
Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 322 comes to you from the Oregon Law Commission, and it relates to judgment. Among other things, requires a conveyance to be delivered and accepted before judgment is entered in order for conveyance to be valid, authorizes single writ of execution, requires an entered judgment, the monetary award be decreased by payments made on behalf of the debtor, increased by interest accrued on judgment, and several other aspects. Sherry Watson from the Law Commission is here, and I also see Dave Hendricks, who was actively involved during the interim on this bill, too.
Very good. Mr. Watson. And Mr. Hendricks, do you want to come up at the same time?
Good morning, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. I'm Gerald Watson, Jerry Watson, with the Oregon Law Commission. And I'm happy to be here on behalf of Senate Bill 322, which you have before you. This bill has passed the Senate. I have distributed some copies of materials to you previously, and I will provide additional copies to staff right now. Senate Bill 322 is basically a cleanup and follow-up bill that addresses a series of issues arising from the adoption of large and significant bills in 2003 and 2005 dealing with judgments and garnishments and judicial sales. For the most part, it seeks to clarify previously adopted provisions of ORS Chapter 18 dealing with matters such as judgment lien priorities, money awards, procedures on execution, and creditor bonding requirements. In addition, in order to eliminate ambiguity and potential confusion, I would be happy to go through each of the sections in order if you would wish, but I think instead of doing that, I will just briefly look at three topics in the bill, and I'd be happy to respond to any questions you might have.
Yeah, I would prefer that. I suspect that unless the committee would like to be walked through each of the changes, because this is a technical kind of bill, technical even from the vantage point of Representative Bonamici and me. So if you could highlight those things which you think are relatively more substantive in their impacts, Mr. Watson, I think
sure.
That would help.
One that is, I think, substantive is the effect of a levy on sheriff's priority. This is the alternate method of levy. It's set out in Section 12. It amends ORS 18.878 to provide that upon levy, the interest of a judgment creditor in personal property is the same as that of a secured creditor with a perfected security interest in the property. The intended effect of that provision is to clarify that a judgment creditor who has levied on personal property has priority over other interests to the fullest extent allowed by law. And really, it's just designed to clarify what is probably already the case. Section 2 and Sections 4 to 7 make some conforming changes to ORS 18.860 and several other sections to make clear that a money award includes post-judgment interest and costs that accrue after the judgment is entered. Again, that wasn't clear, and there was some confusion about whether the amounts to be entered were simply the static number in the judgment document or whether these kind of rolled forward as time passed. And other sections, I think, of some significance have to do with creditor bonds and the requirement for creditor bonds. This is one provision that the Sheriff's Department and departments have been particularly interested in. Those are sections 18 and 19 of the bill, and they clarify the standard that a sheriff would use to request a bond or letter of irrevocable credit to indemnify the sheriff in an execution sale. Sheriffs have indicated clearly that they want clear guidance in terms of what they can do, what they must do. At various places in this bill, we've tried to provide that direction. Sheriff has a wide latitude to request an indemnity bond, and this tightens up some of those provisions. So I will be happy to discuss any other provisions that you think are of interest. I have distributed to you two documents in addition to the summary of the bill, which we usually provide, and the report on the bill. The first is from Mark Comstock, a member of our committee, giving his testimony in support. Mr. Comstock was not able to be here today, but he comes from a background as a business attorney. The second is a testimony that was previously introduced in the House committee by a representative from the Sheriff's Department, also indicating strong support for the bill. Third point I can tell you is this bill received a minor amendment. It was really a very minor amendment encouraged by the Oregon Judicial Department, and they are supportive of the bill as amended. That amendment simply clarified that court administrative staff had no obligation to calculate interest due on a judgment.
Trust Chair. Representative Wisman.
Thank you. Sir, from the January the 27th testimony by Mr. Ross, it says, representatives from the creditor community expressed concerns about additional costs that creditor bonds would impose upon their clients. Is that addressed, or should we still be concerned about that?
Chair McPherson, Representative Wisman, which paragraph of
the third, the last paragraph, next to last sentence. On the other hand, representatives from the creditor community expressed concern about the additional cost.
This is in the memo from the Multnomah County Sheriff's Department.
I think Mr. Hendricks would like to respond to that.
Thank you.
Chairman Person, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks, Legislative Council's Office. The existing structure on creditor bonds, and what we're talking about here is when you've got a judgment creditor who's trying to collect on this judgment amount, and they go to the sheriff and say, "Sheriff, I want you to go seize this property." There was an existing law that said that the sheriff could ask the judgment creditor, the person with the judgment, for a bond to basically protect the sheriff from liability because of whatever they're doing going out and trying to collect this property. I mean, obviously, this is hazardous sort of work here to go out and seize property. And what had happened was, is in many counties, because of the way the language in that statute was written, many of the sheriffs just automatically, every single time, asked for a bond. That was the concern, was that there were a lot of counties where the judgment, if you had a judgment, you always had to come up with this bond. And the statute wasn't really, it kind of allowed that, but it was never intended to be in every single case the sheriff would be able to ask for a bond. So what the amendments to the statute did was try to put some sideboards on that ability to ask for it and say, look, under certain circumstances, if the judgment creditor goes through certain hoops, says certain things, no, you can't require them to go get a bond. So yeah, the whole point of what the amendments to the section is really to try to cut down on those costs to the judgment creditors by not in those certain counties where they were being forced every single time to go and get the bond, which is an expense to the creditor.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, gentlemen, thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wanted to speak on Senate Bill 322? Mr. Marquis, do you have any concern about this bill? Okay. Very good. Then I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 322 and open a work session on Senate Bill 322. This is a standard fare, technical cleanup kind of stuff, committee. Do I hear a motion?
Mr. Chair, I'll move Senate Bill 322 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Cameron moves Senate Bill 322A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Senate Bill 322A moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and this would seem like a good candidate for the consent calendar. So hearing no objection, so ordered. Close the work session on Senate Bill 322A, and now we'll open a public work session on Senate Bill 260.
Chair, members of the committee, this, we had a hearing in this bill back in March 8th. This bill comes to you from the Oregon Advocacy Center. Bob Jindup and Tina Kitchen from the DHS are here on the bill. And what it does is basically is it relates to powers of the guardian and the life situation. It basically ties them into the same statutory framework that most other health care decision makers. Particularly going over to page 2 of the bill on the back, it sets forth what the requirements are, and one of them being that the condition has been medically confirmed, which is ambiguous at best right now as it relates to guardians.
Okay, committee, this bill had generated some discussion when we were considering it before, and so it was rested for a few weeks. My understanding of the bill and informed in our last hearing on it is that it narrows the ability of a guardian to withhold food and water from a person under the guardian's protection, clarifies and limits. Is there any discussion or any question? We do have people in the room who have worked on this bill before, and we could hear further from them if committee members feel they need that. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I recall our discussion about this bill before, and I went back and looked through it, and I think really the key word in this is only, which is on the second page in line 7, only under the circumstances, because it wasn't really clear before that it was narrowing, and I went back and looked at it, and I think it's to set forth the circumstances. Only in these circumstances can a guardian withhold food and water. So I agree that it's a narrowing bill.
Any further discussion?
Only circumstances.
Then do I hear a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 260 to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Barker moves Senate Bill 260 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Hearing none, the clerk call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative
Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Flood.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Wizard.
Nay.
Chairman Carson.
Aye.
Senate Bill 260 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I have a recollection that Representative Gelser had spoken to me about this bill and was taking a special interest in it. And I see some nodding in the back of the room, so with the permission of the committee, I will offer the carrier role to her. Unless she declines, then I'll approach somebody in the committee. Thank you very much. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 260 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 950.
Chairman of the committee, Senate Bill 950 comes with a request from the Oregon Library Association exemption disclosure to the public email addresses of patrons of public libraries.
Mayor Hines is here on behalf of the Library Association.
Very good. Ms. Hines.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Nan Heim, representing the Oregon Library Association, in support of Senate Bill 950. The purpose of this bill is to protect public library patrons' email addresses from disclosure under the public records law. The issue that the bill addresses came to our attention last year when a judge in Florida ruled that a public library had to disclose its patrons' email addresses as requested by a commercial entity. And current Oregon law protects a library patron's name, address, phone number, and circulation materials that have been checked out. The state librarian asked the Attorney General's office for an informal opinion as to whether address could be extended to include email address, address in the current law. And the word came back that no, it probably would not. And that's why we sought introduction of this bill. Public libraries in Oregon now routinely obtain patron email addresses to let you know when a book that you've asked for becomes available, or a book you have is overdue, or special events, etc. And so our members would very much like to see email addresses protected. And the bill was amended in Senate Judiciary Committee because the original version protected the addresses only when connected to a name. And the amended bill that's before you protects the email addresses in and of themselves. And I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Ms. Heim, that was an opinion of DOJ, Ledge Counsel. Who is it who said that address doesn't include email address?
It was an informal opinion from the Attorney General's office.
Okay. Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, ma'am. I guess my question is, a court could still rule to release this information if they had reason to want this or something, right? This is just a, I couldn't call you up and ask for a list of all the email addresses that used the library services.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnant, I think that this would make it much more difficult for a court to rule that the email addresses had to be released.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Because I guess this was probably the result of the Patriot Act, or trying to look at, we talked about how, well, we learned about how email people were using the library's systems for the 9/11, those people were. Is that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnant, I don't think the case in Florida had anything to do with the Patriot Act, actually.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Okay, then I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 950A and open the work session on Senate Bill 950A.
Mr. Chair, I'll move Senate Bill 950 as A to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Cameron moves Senate Bill 950A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, the clerk call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Ford.
Aye.
Representative
Paul. Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnant.
Aye.
Chair McPherson.
Aye. Senate Bill 950A moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And I would say this would be a classic candidate for the consent calendar.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I disagree.
You got a carrier already.
I think we do.
I'll take it, but it's I think that.
I mean, I would have said, Representative, that this, I mean, to me, address, when it didn't say postal address, I would have said that includes an email address. So I kind of wonder if that the need for the bill to begin with. But hearing that you think it needs to be presented on the floor,
it's
Representative?
Simply in my opinion, and I may well be in the minority here. Oh, that's right, I am.
If it were even a close decision, does anybody else think this shouldn't go on the consent calendar?
I'm okay with taking it to the floor. I had some questions.
Okay. I co-sponsored the bill.
I'd be happy
if Representative Flores wants to carry it. That's fine. I'd be happy to co-carry it. We can make a brief presentation.
Yeah, actually, Representative Bonamici, since it's your you are a co-sponsor on the bill, why don't you go ahead and carry it?
Unless Representative Flores wants to carry it,
address in this day and age includes email address. I'm not sure I even see the need for the bill, but
I think making that public and on the record for our colleagues and constituents in this state to understand that might be very helpful.
Okay. Well, we're going to have an opportunity to have that statement made on the floor. We now come to a series of five bills, which are the result of a dependency work group that has been working very diligently on these issues over the interim. And I know that Representative Schaffler and Senator Brown are part of it, and Representative Schaffler was kind of a range of time when they could come together, and Representative Krieger, I know you're part of that group too. Do you think we should get started with you giving us an introduction? Should we try to get them in the room?
Good, I think, to have them all. We've done it that way. We did it that way in the Senate, and I think we played off of each other's comments, which helps.
Okay. Well, why don't we stand at ease then until while we see if we can locate them and let them know that we're ready to do it.
Okay. Terrific.
The House Judiciary Committee for Wednesday, May
2.
We have five bills left on the agenda, all of which cover the same subject matter, and we have a very distinguished panel of legislators to come and present them to us. Let's get a little, a brief introduction from counsel, just to tell us what the general subject matter is, and then we'll hear from our fellow legislators.
Welcome, Mr. Chairman of the Committee. We have before us Senate Bills 408 through 409, 410, 412, 411, 413. And 408 is a bill that they all come from the task force from Representative Senators Brown, Cruz, Krieger, and Schaffler. 408 prohibits the Department of Human Services from filing a petition to terminate parental rights to his or her child only if the court has previously approved the permanency plan for the child. 409 allows the court to direct the Department of Human Services to place a child with parents, relatives, or another foster care provider. 410 is an auxil that sets forth the process and procedure for the Director of Human Services to convene a sensitive review committee for the purposes of reviewing actions and conduct of the department. 412 requires the Department of Human Services, when it receives a report that a child is in substitute care and may have been abused, to notify the child's attorney, the child's parents, a court-appointed special advocate of the child, and the parent's attorney, unless the notification may interfere with the investigation. Yes, and then, let me see. Just bear with me a second here. 413 requires the Department of Human Services to submit a report to the appropriate legislative committee dealing with child welfare matters. Requires that the report to the legislature be filed before November 1st. Requires the report to include about seven additional things.
Very good. Well, I'll let this panel then introduce the bills in whatever order they choose. Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, committee members. For the record, I'm Wayne Krieger, State Representative for District 1. And before I really get into kind of the process, I wanted to express my appreciation to these three people sitting next to me who have spent 14 to 15 months working on this, hardly anybody missing a meeting, and really making it a priority. And at some times, great inconvenience to us during the interim where a two-hour meeting would call maybe a 500-mile round trip, but we all got there.
Just to interject, Senator Jeff Cruz, Senate District 1. One of the meetings, Representative Krieger came up shortly after having surgery and shouldn't have been there, but just to point the level of commitment.
I made it because I was wearing a girdle to keep my belly.
Thanks for sharing, Representative Krieger.
Cut him like a fish.
What I wanted to talk about is a little bit about the process of how it all came about. And it came about as a result of a bill that we had in this room last session where we were making an inquiry and we could not get the information because the information was confidential. Out of that came a Mr. Taylor helped arrange through Department of Human Resources and Dr. Goldberg a sensitive review committee, which was allowed by law, had never been used. And on that committee, Representative Flores, Richards, myself, and Schaffler sat, along with CASA, Dr. Goldberg, Ramona Foley, Mickey Cerise, Nancy Miller, and some DHS staff. It was a great process. And a couple people asked me, you know, what was Schaffler doing there, Representative Schaffler, because it was not kind of his forte.
That's true.
And I told them that I was looking for a person with a type B personality who was known to be unopinionated.
And when you couldn't find that in this building.
has been a learning experience for all of us. Out that particular case that we looked into in Lincoln County comprised 3,500 pages. It had been on the books and going. The children had been in the custody of DHS for 3 years. Grandparents hadn't seen the little girl for 3 years, mother for a couple of years. Joe O'Leary had reduced the paperwork down to 310 pages. That got us to three meetings with the Sensitive Review Committee and 38 questions for DHS. When we finished that, the case had been remanded back from the appeals court, Judge Brewer, and we started a working group, which includes the people that you see here today, committed to taking a look at all the information that came in over that 15 months, and Senator Cruz will address those that were here, took part, and ones that testified, and who we brought in to get information. Chief Justice Paul Jimenez had invited us to work with him in a process of some of the things that dealt with the frozen record issue and the court process and appeals issues, and we're still doing that when we can meet. It's been difficult to get over there. And the same with Judge Brewer, because after Judge Brewer sent the case back from Lincoln County on appeal to DHS, I asked Joe O'Leary, who was our staff attorney at the time, whether it would be inappropriate or appropriate for us to talk to him. And the judge said, hey, I've adjudicated the case. Yeah, we can talk. So we spent an hour and a half together. And it was great, the suggestions and ideas that he brought to us from his perspective of hearing these type of cases in court and what the type of things he had to deal with because of what was not done proper at the lower court or within the agency that was dealing with these children and families. The outcome of that was 8 or 9 legislative bills, administrative rule changes that the Department of DHS is going to make, a commitment for better training for our caseworkers. They have extremely difficult job to do. They're darned if they do, darned if they don't. Sometimes you've seen that happen to them. We also found that it was, I think, extremely important to have better training for attorneys that take these cases and work them. The particular one on this case had 22 complaint violations and actually gave up his bar standing. So that was the type of representation the family got. And that was probably, to my way of thinking, one of the root of our problems with that is unequal representation, where the state pays $7,000 or $8,000 to represent the family and they have a bill for $7,000 or $80,000 to the state. That's not equal representation. And Judge Brewer really explained that in detail one day to Speaker Menace, because we wanted to make sure at the time that she knew what we were doing. We kept her informed as we were going through the work group. The state bar is going to be providing a new program for better training for the attorneys that deal in these cases, and that would involve later that these attorneys would have increased compensation if they completed that training. And as representation for DHS caseworkers, half the time they're representing the state of Oregon in the courtroom. They're not attorneys, and we need to make sure that they're properly represented. Some of the mistakes we found would not have happened if both the state and the families involved had better representation. And the quality of that representation, I think, will really improve if the packages and these bills you look at, and one of them calls for some increased compensation, it's expensive. But I think long-term, though, you can't qualify savings, just like the meth package that we spent $11 million and saved $158 million. I would not be surprised. This couldn't at least be a break-even. And that does not count the quality of life of reuniting families and providing the services for them, both the children and the parents. So I'll stop there and let the other members go forward with their point.
Okay. Once again, Senator Jeff Cruz, Senate District 1. This group that you see in front of you, Senator Brown, labeled us the Motley Crew, and it's been a pleasure to work with this group and all of the other parties on an issue that we all have a great deal of passion for, and this became incredibly collaborative, probably to a degree that I'm not sure I've necessarily ever seen on a specific issue. We had We collaborated with the governor's office, the attorney general's office, the juvenile rights project, in the justice system, the appellate supreme and circuit courts, CASA, CRB, public defender's office, district attorneys, and members of the House and Senate. So this was incredibly comprehensive, and some of the bills Representative Krieger was talking about are not before you because they're in Ways and Means and they're critical pieces to this. And there are other bills that are part of decision packages in both the Attorney General's budget and the Governor's budget. A prime example, one that at this point the co-chairs have eliminated, was to take a portion of the hard liquor tax and direct that specifically into treatment for parents when the kids have been removed from the home, and you know, in our attempt to try to unify the families once again. So there are decisions involving the work we have done that will take place in venues outside of judiciary committees, and we have done our best to communicate with co-chairs what the need is and what the outcomes need to be. Big picture, it's not a lot of money, but it's important, and also a big picture understanding that the Ways and Means folks have an incredible job ahead of them. But, you know, some of the things that surprised me, you know, just on a personal level, was finding myself collaborating with folks that historically I maybe never had before. But and quite honestly, I asked the president to put me on the Senate Judiciary Committee specifically for this agenda. And judiciary has been an incredible learning curve on other issues as well. But we wanted to make sure that one of our folks was present there. And I carried all but, I think you carried one of the bills in this package. I carried the others on the floor of the Senate. They all passed unanimously because I think we did a really good job of informing the members of the Senate of the work we had done in these issues. You know, it's I mean, it's just interesting. One of the bills you don't have is Senate Bill 282, which was a juvenile rights project kind of omnibus bill that we have basically taken pieces of it and put in other bills and made that one of the funding bills. But, you know, at my first meeting with them early in January, they came in to talk about their bill, and we had our bills, and it was amazing how well all things had lined up, and basically some of their language we like better than the language we had. So, you know, they're at this point, there's really no opposition that we are aware of because all parties have been present. You know, at this point, my confidence in the ability of the House to view these bills and pass the substantive pieces is very high. And but the issues we still have in front of us are the issues probably in the Ways and Means Committee, and we would ask for your help in communicating with the members down there the importance of, for example, making sure that we have appropriate representation for all parties when they go to court. That was one of the issues we had from the justice, was the fact that it's somewhat frustrating from their perspective because all they can rule on is what's on the record when it comes for appeal, and if we don't have appropriate representation at the front end, there's a high likelihood that all facts aren't presented, and we need to make sure that they have all facts on record so they can make the appropriate decisions. And, you know, some things the Attorney General has brought forward with, you know, creating a clear, bright line between district attorneys and AAGs as to jurisdiction, and also the fact that he would like to have specific points in time for review of cases. You know, there's a whole lot more accountability that is being built into the system to make sure that we are moving in the proper direction that's in the best interest of the kid, whether it's towards reunification or whether it's towards termination of parental rights, and after that the ability to place the kids appropriately and do it in a shorter time frame. So I'm here to help answer any questions, but my job in this presentation was just to inform you of the incredibly collaborative body of work we have put together here, and I've been very proud to be part of this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is the crew. I'm the motley. I'm Mike Schaffler, State Representative, House District 48, Happy Valley, Southeast Portland. And when Representative Krieger, who I want to thank for getting me involved in this, when I saw the email that I was going to be on this, I'm going, oh, my God, what has he gotten me into? I'm far more comfortable with business, labor, natural resources. Matter of fact, I'd rather discuss public employment, retirement system, and land use, to be quite frank with you, than family law, because it is a very, it's a very emotional part of the law. And but I do want to thank all three of these people for their patience, as well as Bill Taylor, Joe Leary, Mara Gross, Dr. Goldberg, Ramona Foley, Mickey Cerise, Appellate Court Justice David Brewer, because I attend those meetings as well, and a long growing list of experts that have helped me as a legislator who is just a layman in the end wade through these complex issues. But in the end, I mean, I was a child that didn't grow up in an environment that was always perfect. I'm a parent. I don't claim to be a perfect parent, but my daughter's growing up in a Leave It to Beaver world relative to what I did, and I'm eternally grateful for that. But when we're dealing with all these issues, I did, through the interim sensitive review committee, which Representative Flores and Representative Dennis Richardson also participated in, clearly there were some glaring inconsistencies and holes. And I don't think really it was anyone's fault, but I think the folks that are dealing with this have to have clear direction and the money to do the job, because when we're talking about a child who didn't ask to be born, we have to be batting 1,000. And when we're talking about considering taking a child out of their home, we better darn well be have our ducks in a row and be right, and be fair to the parents, the extended family, and the child, because in the end, I can't think of anything more important than the safety, health, and welfare of our children. And as Representative Krieger has frequently said, we're seeking justice here for all those reasons. I think we've taken great steps towards doing that. This process is not over. David Brewer's group met the other day. I went to that. We talked about the transcription of records, court records, which, you know, is incredibly complex in and of itself, just that one little narrow part, and certification, a national certification, et cetera. I don't know what we're all going to do there, but this process will continue. But I think we're taking some excellent, positive steps in the right direction. I appreciate you listening to us. These are good bills, should pass, and I'll do everything I can to help answer any questions. Senator Brown.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Schaffler. Thank you very much, committee members, for hearing this package of bills. We're really excited, and I just want to say thank you to my colleagues who've worked so hard on this package. For the record, State Senator Kate Brown, I represent Senate District 21. I just want to give you a little perspective about how I came to work on this package with these group of guys. Last interim, as most of you know, I went to work, back to work, for the Juvenile Rights Project, and I had a year contract with them. It was the first time I'd been in juvenile court for 10 years. I used to do both family and juvenile law. Took a little break to work on the legislative work. So I showed up in their offices in the beginning of the year in January, and was handed a lot of files. It started out to be 30, and then it was 40, and over the interim it grew to 60. Now, the last time I'd been in juvenile court, I'd had over 100 cases, and I was working 20 hours a week. This time, I will tell you, 60 files seemed like a piece of cake. Well, the difference was, the last time I was in juvenile court, I was representing parents. And so each file represented essentially one client. Well, at Juvenile Rights Project, the majority of their clients are children. And so instead of each file representing one client, they represented a family. So I will tell you, I had two cases come in spring, March, April, where there were four children on the case, and because of the age of the children, they were all under seven. I represented all four of those children on all those cases. So the number of actual clients I had was 94. it was a lot, and these were wee ones, and even though I'm an experienced lawyer, it was a lot to handle. So that really motivated me to make sure that one of the bills that we passed this session is Senate Bill 411, which it would is not in front of this committee, which would do two things. It would reduce caseloads for the attorneys, increase compensation, and at the same token, improve quality training. And I will tell you, after having practiced in the juvenile court area and never having been trained, this last year was a real wake-up call. I attended two-day CLEs, continuing legal education programs, and most recently spoke at another one, even though I'm not practicing now. And then Juvenile Rights Project, we had at least 2 weeks of training in the mornings, 7:30 to 9 every day. I did not attend, I confess, all of those, because I had a hard time coordinating, but the training was incredible and very valuable, and I think really attributed to my ability to represent mostly wee ones much more effectively. So I got involved with these guys because of my interest in improving the foster care system, and I'm just going to do a little walkthrough of the bills for you. I know that Bill Taylor went through them. I just want to give you a kind of a background. I will tell you that Senate Bill 408, which prohibits the Department of Human Services from filing a petition to terminate parental rights for the sole reason that the child has been in substitute care for 15 of 22 months, unless the court has previously determined that the plan for the child should be adoption, really came out of the sensitive review case. And in that case, as Representative Flores knows, the plan for the child was returned to parent, and a termination petition was filed, I believe, by the agency and moved forward on and actually succeeded at the trial court level. So we want to make sure when the department moves forward in filing a petition for termination that there is a permanent plan for the child, that child is an adoption. We do not want children languishing in foster care that are available for adoption. We have over 300 at this point in time. So this comes out of your sensitive review committee. Senate Bill 409 comes out, I think, out of the sensitive review committee, but it's also sort of a work product. It clarifies law by adding relatives or persons who have a caregiver relationship as people to whom the court may direct DHS to place a child. And the reason why this bill is here is that only 30% of children have been placed in Oregon are placed in relative foster care. We know that when children are placed in relative foster care, the outcomes are better, that they are more likely to be returned to their parents, and their placements are more successful. The companion bill, and there are a couple of them to this one, is Senate Bill 282, which provides funding for relative foster care. The agency is actually moving forward on this in itself. This Senate Bill 282 would provide all relatives the funding to provide foster care. Oregon is one of two states that denies basic support to children living with relatives when the child is not Title IV eligible, living in poverty. So that's gone down to your Ways and Means Committee, but I wanted to point that bill out because I think it's critically important. Senate Bill 410 authorizes the Director of Department of Human Services to convene a sensitive review committee. We think this is critically important. It clarifies statute around this area. It allows either the Senate President or the Speaker to request the Department to authorize a sensitive review committee. Representative Flores can testify to how critical this was in this particular case. I will say that the Department, under the leadership of Dr. Goldberg, is really moving forward and doing these sensitive review cases on a random basis, on a quarterly basis around the state. I think that puts caseworkers and, frankly, lawyers working in the system on notice that they're going to be another set of eyes looking at these cases, and we think that's critically important. Senate Bill 411, I mentioned already, which is the money to Public Defense Services Commission. I want to say one more thing about that, and I know Representative Barker is down on the Public Safety Ways Committee. We know that when the caseloads have been reduced for attorneys representing either parents or children in foster care. We know that when we reduce the caseloads, that the children spend less time in foster care. And we know that based on a pilot study in the state of Washington. When attorney caseloads were reduced, children spent on an average about 50 days less in foster care, which is huge savings, frankly, to the state, but also that's just a really good thing. The other thing that happens when we reduce caseloads is that the outcomes are better. And by that, what I mean is when we return the children to the parents, which is our goal here, it is less likely that the state will get involved with the family again. So we see reducing caseloads, improving compensation as a critical component to making this successful. And I will also tell you that based on our numbers, based on the numbers given us to DHS, if we spend, for example, roughly $23 million, which sounds like a lot, on reducing caseloads, we believe the savings will be about that much in terms of reducing the time that children spend in foster care.
Or more.
Thank you, Senator Cruz. Senate Bill 412, I have to tell you, this comes out of my personal experiences last year in handling these cases, and these guys were willing to go along with it, but they also thought it was important. It requires the agency to notify the child's attorney, the CASA, and the parent's attorney, if the parents are not the abusers, when the child has been abused in foster care. And I actually had not one but two cases, and one is just horrible because it was what I would call a red flag case. It was a high priority case, and because of our caseloads, we triaged. But this little kid, I was on the phone to this caseworker very regularly. We have hearings about every 90 days on these cases, particularly on these what I would call red flag cases. And I showed up in court. We'd had a court appearance in June. I believe the incident happened in July, over 4th of July weekend, and I showed up for a September court appearance. And despite my regular contact with, frankly, the foster parents and with the agency, no one told me that my client, my little kid, had been bitten by a dog over 4th of July weekend. I didn't know. And there was no duty in statute for the caseworker to notify. So this comes out of that particular experience. We think it's critically important that the parties involved should know when there's been a child's been abused in foster care. Let's see, moving along. 411, I talked about 413 also is before you, and you just received a technical amendment. This comes to you. It's a combination work product, but basically our goal here is to get more information from the agency about what's happening to children in foster care. And the initial idea was from Juvenile Rights Project. They wanted to see numbers of foster care placements, numbers of school placements, at times children get to both dental care and medical care while they're in foster care. I will just tell you that from my perspective, every place in the system is overloaded. But one of the biggest problems that we face is the multiple placements that these kiddos have while they're in foster care. And to give you the worst example I saw, I was handed a file that the young woman had been in foster care for about 10 years. She, during that time frame, had 68 foster care placements. It was just awful. And unfortunately, by the time we closed the case, she had 74 placements. Now, at that point in time, it was hard to tell whether the system, was at fault, the chicken and egg, who was at fault in all of this. But I will tell you that if we placed our own children in 60 placements in 10 years, we would not recognize them. And so we have really got to focus on reducing the multiple placements. What we're asking the agency to do in Senate Bill 413 is to really start tracking these kids. We're hoping to expand on this. I'll be frank with you next session, but we want more information, including medical care and school placements. Also, last session, we passed a bill looking at school changes and requiring the agency, when there's been a change in foster care, to pay for transportation costs because we're having children move from school to school. And I just think that's one of the issues that we need to highlight in this report. I think we'll do that. Senator Cruz, go ahead.
If I could interject, what we came down to on what we wanted them to look at, we were sensitive to the other budgetary implications in our package. And so basically we are asking for reports on information already being gathered so there would not be a fiscal impact on the department to do this. But we felt it was important that we have access to that information. So that was the reason for the list. And Senator Brown's right. We will probably be expanding that over time to include more finding of fact. But we're also looking at this as a long-term project, and so this was the first step in it. And I'd also say for the record that we support the Dash A3 amendment.
Thank you, Senator Cruz. And at Dash A3, as we were reviewing this bill, apparently the report is a biannual report, but the time period requirement for the agency to provide data was only 12 months, so we thought we should change that to 24 months. So we'd really appreciate that amendment. I just want to close with mentioning a couple other bills that will not be before you unless the Speaker pulls them out of Ways and Means and sends them to House Judiciary. One is Senate Bill 414, and we think this is critically important. It raises the level of scrutiny on the agency for placing children with relatives and siblings. Right now, the agency is required to make reasonable efforts. This raises the level to diligent. I would tell you that I would put that at a 75% level. The other level that standard we deal with in juvenile court is active efforts, and that's for Indian Child Welfare Act cases. So this would increase the level of scrutiny and, frankly, the effort that the agency should go to in placing foster kids and with both their siblings and their relatives. And I can go on ad nauseum on this issue, but the data is really good. JRP will probably give you so much data you won't know what to do with it. And then lastly, I did want to mention Senate Bill 415, which is what we will call Marissa's Law. All of us feel it's critically important to establish an ombudsperson to address these cases, and this would be within the governor's office as opposed to under the arm of the agency. I think Representative Krieger's probably the funnel here, but we all get these cases, cases that are difficult, cases where things have gone awry on a regular basis, and we think there should be a person to whom we can and the public can go to ask for assistance and advocacy and information. So that is also down in Ways and Means, but I just wanted to raise that to all of you.
And we considered it important to have this position in the governor's office. So I mean, it will be housed, obviously, in DHS, but we felt it important that an advocacy of this level needed to be under the jurisdiction of the governor rather than the jurisdiction of the agency.
So with that, I just want to say thank you very much. The one thing I saw in my 10-year hiatus is that the level of damage that we are seeing to these children that are coming into foster care has really increased. We are seeing, for example, in Multnomah County, the most serious of the serious cases. One of the families that I picked up with the four kiddos that are just as cute as can be, the family had been referred 12 and 13 times before we actually had a petition filed and the agency took custody of the kids. So I don't want to detail the level of damage that we saw on these children, but it was severe, and I don't know that we can ever correct it. I'm hoping with intense services that these little kiddos are going to be okay. But I think it's critically important that we spend some more time and energy improving our foster care system. And I just thank you for giving this issue the time and energy that it needs.
Representative Krieger.
I think you can see why it worked. Right people, the right skills. Great to have both the senators come in. And when I found out that Senator Brown actually worked in this field, I said, we're going to get this done. That was really kind of remind me of the work group you and I were on with the MET package last session. I wanted to update you just a little bit about the case in Lincoln City, because it became more public because it was in the newspaper. The Rose Lucas was the mother. Dr. Goldberg did meet with her for the first time. She was able to get her side of the story out. He met for an hour with her. I got a call. I can't remember the first time if I called her or she called me, but it was about a year ago, a little over a year ago. And it was just about the time, within 3 weeks, she was going to get to see her granddaughter for the first time in 3 years. And,
okay. Well, thank you very much. This process really proceeds only when legislators take on issues, ones that they have particular experience with or not, and roll up their sleeves and dig in and learn more about it than they knew before, whether they have prior experience or not, and then craft out of that good public policy proposals. And so the state is in debt to the four of you for providing leadership on this issue.
Hey, Mr. Chair, I'd also point out that we went into this purposely not trying to blame anybody for anything. We just wanted to fix the system. And I do want to echo the commitment we have had from the Department of Human Services to change the way they have been operating and to try to make sure that caseworkers have appropriate training. Has been very good. And Ramona Foley has been a real gem in this, as well as Dr. Goldberg. And so the agency has truly stepped up to the plate.
Okay. Now we're in council.
Mr. Members of the committee, what I'd like to add to this is one of the roles of the legislature is oversight. In this area, it's all but impossible because all the records are not subject to public disclosure unless all the parties agree. And that's the significance of the sensitive review process and the ombudsman, in the sense that they will both are able to look beyond into those records that are otherwise not made public. So if we were looking at the Department of Corrections, we could look at their records. When we get into this area of dependency, we cannot.
Okay. Committee, we're in public hearing on the five bills that are before us today, 408, 409, 410, 412, 413. Senator Brown walked us briefly through those. There may well be questions about particular bills. We also have Amy Miller from the Juvenile Rights Project signed up, and so we could excuse some or all of the legislative panel, depending on what other commitments they have. You could bring Ms. Miller up to respond to particular questions.
Before we excuse the panel, I just want to thank them for the great work and as a panel. But Senator Brown, I want to thank you for bringing the real world experience to the table. And I want to be clear: you mentioned some bill. We've got the five bills before us. We have Senate Bill 414. That's in Ways and Means. We have Senate Bill 415. Is that in Ways and Means as well?
Senate Bill 411, 414, and 415 and 282. I believe 411 and I believe 411 will be in front of the Public Safety Sub. The others may be in front of the Human Services Sub, but Ms. Miller may know more.
Yeah, but they're all in Ways and
Means. Yes.
Okay. So it's four other bills we're looking at with this panel.
And the number that was out of sequence again, which number is that?
282.
282. Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
And according to Ms. Miller, they have not been assigned yet, so they're waiting.
One more follow-up question, if I may, on Senate Bill 412. Senator Brown, you mentioned that's the one that the reporting of the abuse within someplace. And my question is that strong enough? I'm looking at the language. Is that strong enough that in the case of a dog bite, that would be abuse that would have to be reported?
Representative Cameron, Mr. Chair, I would actually, as an attorney, I would include that within my reporting requirements, but Ms. Miller may disagree. A child bitten in foster care, I assume that goes to the abuse hotline.
Abuse.
Members of the committee, Representative Cameron, I would agree with Senator Brown on that. I would make that report. My name is Amy Miller. I'm a staff attorney at the Juvenile Rights Project. I would also make a mandatory report on that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for all the work to the senators. I had a bill. I was concerned with priority for grandparents and relatives, mm-hmm. and paying grandparents and parents, I guess, and that's 414.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, it's actually what I would say is three bills. The first one would be Senate Bill 409, which gives the court authority to direct placement for a relative or caregiver, someone in a caregiver relationship. The other one is Senate Bill 414, and the last one is Senate Bill 282, which is the funding piece.
Also, did you talk about, like, I have a situation where it's the grandparent has the sister, and that's not even considered in the case. There's, not only do you have the grandparent seeking custody, now the grandparents have the sister of the person being placed. So let me. The other thing is on 413. Did you talk about the may I proceed or
go ahead?
Is that the time requested to place a child in a permanent situation. You don't have time. I don't think is one of the seven items. You added that in an amendment. Should we be concerned with the time? My case is, and Representative Krieger talked about 3 years. My case is over 2 years old.
You're talking about the amendment 413?
Well, you did amend it and added other things to the original. So I'm saying, did you talk about adding time requested, time required for permanent placement? Was that did you consider that? Would that be something we'd want to think about?
The amendment is on Senate Bill 413, which is the reporting bill, to change the 12-month data collection framework to 24 months. And I think what you're asking, I believe, Representative Wisnett, is whether these bills would apply to cases pending. Okay.
No, Senator.
Then ask your
question. This report is asking all the time, so shouldn't we also want to be concerned about how long it took from the case starting until you actually put the child in a permanent placement, I'm saying.
Got it. Okay.
Representative Krieger had one of 3 years last, so is that something we might want to add to that report?
Chair McPherson, Representative Wisnett, I believe that data is already tracked by DHS.
It's not listed in that report.
I do believe it's already checked by DHS, but the folks from DHS could probably come up and clarify that.
On 410, I think this sensitive, I'll have to talk to some of the members on this sensitive case, but your bill 410 doesn't say, it says the DHS may convene it. I mean, how do we force that, and how can a legislator, how can a citizen get this sensitive review going?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if we put shall in there, we would have a constitutional problem. And we would have as a separation of powers problem. The legislative branch, it's an executive function. What we're doing is strongly suggesting that they do it, but we can't mandate that they do it.
Who can initiate the request, and where does that request go to?
Mr. Chair, if I could, the way we've designed this is if a member has a case that they have concern about, they would take that concern to the president or the speaker, depending upon which chamber they are, and at that point the speaker or the president would have a conversation with DHS, lay the facts out, and you're right, we can't mandate, but it would be incumbent upon DHS to at least investigate, and if they're not going to move forward, give valid reasons not to. So we think it needs to be collaborative, and we think this is collaborative, and at the same time not opening it up for a free-for-all, which is why we have the nexus through leadership to make sure that we aren't having 90 people converging on the department with requests.
Thank you. My last question or issue is, I really think this family fine that we tried to pass in my bill is an important program. We're doing some testing in it now. It was supported by the State Commission on Children and Families. I attended a seminar. It's not just for placement. It's for a connection with people in the system. And I think I would hope that we can, if we don't do it this time, next time we can look at doing some more test pilot programs and even see if we can train DHS workers to do that. Thank you for your work.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, I just want to respond, and I think Ms. Miller can give you eons of data about how critical it is for the relative and sibling connection. I just want to share with you one story. I had a little 10-year-old I represented. I also represented his older siblings. The older siblings were in permanent foster care. The state moved to terminate the mother's parental rights to the 10-year-old. We ended up opposing that termination and placing him in what I would call permanent foster care as well, because once we terminated his mother's parental rights, there would be no legal connection between the 12-year-old and his older sisters. And that was the connection that he held on to and kept him going. So we know that the sibling-relative connections are critically important. I think the law is a little slow to reflect societal, both our research and our mores in this area, but we will get there. But we know that sibling and relative, in fact, there was a Time magazine article on the importance of sibling connections, how critical it is. So, you want to say anything?
Okay. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you so much to everyone for all this critically important work. My question was also about the sensitive review committee, and it looks like there are some safeguards in it, and it looks like very important work. The DHS is going to adopt some rules. Are there analogous sensitive review proceedings that happen in other areas, so there's some guidance? Because I can see where it could grow to be something tremendous. It would be a huge workload, and I'm just concerned about making sure that it's doing what it is intended to do.
I'm not aware of any other areas, and it may be something we look at in the future, but I understand your concern. So the nexus we have created here for convening, and also, as Senator Brown pointed out, the ombudsperson could also play in that part. We are not assuming that we're going to overwhelm the system at this point. But there's also the fact that all of us are committed to continuing this work out into the future, and so we're going to stay on top of this. And quite honestly, we haven't created a perfect anything yet, but I think we're moving in the right direction. And so if adjustments need to be made.
Thank you. And follow up, please?
Go ahead.
There's no definition of sensitive review, but I assume it's just a deep look into one particular case at a time. Is that correct?
Yeah. The sensitive review, it's already in statute. So all we're doing is activating something that already exists to a large degree.
Thank you.
Chair, members of the committee, one of the interesting things about sensitive review, it's only mentioned once in the ORS, and it's mentioned as being an exemption to the non-disclosure of records. What we had to do here was set forth really in statute what was developing practice and procedure. So now what it will be in statute. And it'll be set forth, and it will not be just an add-on to the exemption from non-disclosure.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And currently, the director of the Department of Human Services is the one who can call for the sensitive review committee, oftentimes because information has been brought to him that is a symptom of a problem, often and would obviously be an anomaly, but it is an anomaly that would carry system-wide, and that's why he would make the determination, and in this last instance made the determination that this particular case needed to be reviewed for somewhere where the system has been not addressing the situation satisfactorily, or that it's broken down, or the system's just plain broken. So that was the determination. I really like the idea that at the request and direction of the Speaker, the Senate President, we can proceed with that as well.
Chair McPherson, Representative Bonamici, also to maybe provide a little clarification or information on your question. The statute does give DHS the authority to make rules regarding investigations, and there are currently a couple of different procedures laid out in administrative rule, for example, in responding to like a critical incident or a fatality, I believe. And again, the folks from DHS could probably speak to that. But there are some processes laid out which may be the place to borrow from going forward.
Mr. Chair. Representative Krieger. If I recall, DHS had made a commitment to change the manner in which a complaint would come in from the field to an office and how that would be handled up the line. Mr. Goldberg had spoke to that, or Ramona had, I remember at one time, to try to make sure things weren't kind of corralled at the local level and it didn't go any further. And that's why we think the
Osmond portion of that, where those things would go to him, too, a copy, would be really important.
Any further questions?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, the only other thing I was going to mention when Representative Krieger was talking about the balance of the legal fund representation is obviously a problem, and how much, because I don't understand exactly. I know last session we looked at providing a lawyer for DHS every time they went to one of these, and it was cost prohibitive, of course. But I know from my case that the parents are out $20,000, and DHS has been representing them very well. So I don't know how this bill, that I guess it's 411 in Ways and Means, is working, but.
Well, I think Representative Krieger can actually talk to Mr. Chair, or Representative that. Representative Krieger can talk about the cost of the Sensitive Review Committee, and I think we laid those out in a letter we sent to the co-chairs in terms of the discrepancy for lawyer costs for the parent versus lawyer costs for the state. But you all should be aware that in the Department of Justice, Department of Human Services budgetary request, there is a request for funding in the governor's budget for an assistant attorney general to review every single juvenile dependency cases at two critical stages, 5 months and 11 months. And my recollection off the top of my head is that the fiscal is about $3 million, $4 million, so it's relatively low. But we think it would have prevented the case like the sensitive review case, because you've got a set of outside eyes, legal eyes, looking at the case, making sure that it's legally on track. And we think that would have avoided the sensitive review committee case that our colleagues saw. So I think it's a really important investment. I think all of us would agree that that's critically important. We are the most under-lawyered. There's so many lawyers in juvenile court, I can't believe I say this, but we are one of the most under-lawyered states because there is no lawyer on a regular basis representing the agency in these juvenile court cases. At critical points, there are lawyers, whether it's the district attorney representing the state, or in cases the department is represented, but it is not on a regular basis. It's not countywide, and I think it certainly causes problems at multiple levels.
And I'd also point out that in the Attorney General's budget request, where they do draw a bright line between the AG and district attorneys, they also have more funding in for the DAs to be able to fulfill the function that they're being given in this.
Right. I want to follow up with that, just on that last point, Senator Brown, that you made. We don't necessarily provide an agency lawyer at these proceedings, but I believe we provide counsel not just to the parents, because it's constitutionally required, but also to the children. In addition, so we have mom's lawyer, maybe dad's lawyer. We have the child's lawyer. And then we're going to be funding the agency lawyer to be there as well.
Mr. Chair, that's a really good question. I will tell you, and this is an issue we've worked on a number of years, that not all children in the state of Oregon have lawyers. In Multnomah County, all those children are represented. But it varies countywide based on resources, and maybe Ms. Miller can address that further. The other issue you raise is a lawyer for the agency, for the caseworker. And the governor's budget proposes simply an assistant attorney general to review each case at the critical, the 5 months and the 11 months periods. It doesn't actually provide the resources for the caseworker to be represented on a full-time basis. I think that folks that have worked in this arena for a long time would tell you that if the agency were to be provided the caseworker, a lawyer, that these cases might move more effectively and might be more productive, because the caseworker's put in a fairly awkward role. He or she doesn't have a lawyer. But Ms. Miller, I don't know if you wanted to add anything to that.
No, I think you've summed up very nicely. Thank you.
And quite honestly, you know, whether a child has a lawyer or not, just having a lawyer doesn't say a lot. If the lawyer gets the file out in the hall before they go into court, it's not really a lawyer. So that's the reason for the additional funding request, so that we can reduce the caseload and also incent more people into the field so that they can actually have reviewed the case before they go to court. So.
Chair members of the committee, what came out in the sensitive review of the particular case that Representative Krieger has talked about is that the state spent approximately $118,000 on legal fees. The family was allocated around $20,000, and obviously the gentleman who represented the family in the Court of Appeals did a very good job because he won the case, and he is a very good lawyer. But at the circuit court, it was obvious that the attorney, the way he handled the case, left something to be desired.
Okay, committee.
Just a comment about that case again. You know, the family has been reunited, and, you know, my staff person, you all know who that is, she spends hundreds of hours, not only with people in our district, but other district, and working with Mickey Cerise. There's another family we've got back together as a result of that, working on a fourth one. But she's got about four or five of those going. But I did receive a real nice picture of the little girl and the mother. And I got a great big Christmas card of about 20 of the family people out in front of their house with the mother there. So that was kind of moving.
Mr. Chair, I just would like, before the senators leave, thank you very much, Senator Brown, Senator Cruz, obviously Representative Krieger and Representative Schaffler, wherever you are, for picking up the ball and moving forward with some of the very critical issues that did come forward from the Sensitive Review Committee. And I appreciate your guidance, your continuing to turn the wheel, because this is, as Representative Krieger said, it's a very emotional issue. And these are the most vulnerable, and I'm so glad that something is very positively happening for the system to make it better for them. Thank you.
And I'd just like to point out, Mr. Chair, a word picture because we're on camera. I mean, look at this trio here. It's so unusual. No, we will continue working in the future, and it's, we've done some very good stuff.
It's so strong families come together.
Thank you.
Okay, if there are no further questions, then thank you very much for being in here in public hearing. We're going to close the public hearings.
Representative McPherson, I'm sorry to interrupt you. Really quickly, can I just put on the record that the Juvenile Rights Project is here to offer support of these bills? Oh, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Miller. I will now close the public hearing on Senate Bill 408, Senate Bill 409, Senate Bill 410, Senate Bill 412, and Senate Bill 413. And open a work session on Senate Bill 408, 409, 410, 412, and 413.
Do you want an individual motion, or do you want them on all of them?
We probably need to be able to record have a recorded vote on each of these bills. Okay. So let's just do them quickly one at a time. And we do, and one of them will have an amendment.
413's got a dash one, doesn't it?
Yes. Right. So we're in work session then. Let's take 408, so just take them in numerical order.
I'd like to move Senate Bill 408 to the floor, House floor, if it do pass.
Representative Krieger moves Senate Bill 408A to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Any discussion? If not, the clerk call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Excused.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Fox?
Excused.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barber?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnik?
Aye.
Chairman
Crossman? Aye. Senate Bill 408 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and I was, Representative Krieger, I was going to ask,
I would like to carry all of them with Representative Schaffer as co-carrier.
Very good. We will try to accomplish that. Okay, Senate Bill 409 then.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Senate Bill 409 to the floor if it do pass.
Representative Krieger moves Senate Bill 409A to the floor with the do pass recommendation. Any discussion? If not, call the roll.
Representative
Bonamici,
aye. Representative Cameron, excused. Representative Flores,
aye.
Representative Koff, excused. Representative Krieger,
aye.
Representative Reed,
aye.
Vice Chair Barker,
aye.
Vice Chair Wisnik,
aye.
Chairman Crossman,
aye. And Representative Cameron is now in the room, so he can vote on Senate Bill 409.
Aye.
Would you like to vote on 408 as well?
Yes.
We request unanimous consent to suspend the rules to permit Representative Cameron to vote on Senate Bill 408.
Votes aye. Oh, sorry.
Hearing no objections, so
votes aye.
Representative Cameron votes aye on Senate Bill 408. Okay, so Senate Bill 409 then moves to the floor with a due pass. Senate Bill 410.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move Senate Bill 410 to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Krieger moves Senate Bill 410A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? If not, can you call the roll?
Representative Bonaducci.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Kopp, excused. Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnant.
Aye.
Chairman Parsons.
Aye. Senate Bill 410A moves to the floor of the due pass. Now Senate Bill 412.
Chair, I'd like to move Senate Bill 412A to the floor of the due pass.
Representative Krieger moves Senate Bill 412A to the floor of the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? If not, call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Cobb, excuse. Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnant.
Aye.
Chairman Parsons.
Aye. Senate Bill 412 moves to the floor of the due pass. Senate Bill 413.
Mr. Chair, I move the A3 amendments into Senate Bill 413.
Representative Barker moves the A3 amendments into Senate Bill 413. Any discussion? Any objection? The A3 amendments are in the bill.
Mr. Chair, moves Senate Bill 413 as amended to the floor of the due pass.
Representative Barker moves Senate Bill 413A as amended to the floor of the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Cobb, excuse. Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Representative Barker.
Aye.
Aye. I will, Senate Bill 413A moves to the floor of the due pass recommendation, and Representative Krieger and Representative Schaffer will co-carry the five bills that we just worked. I will close the work sessions on Senate Bill 408, 409, 410, 412, and 413. That concludes our agenda. We are adjourned.